KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
Seattle.
The sound of the Big Bang, life, writing, and studying birds, how you can transition from one career to the next. All coming up this hour on Weekday. I'm Steve Scheer. Thanks for being here. What does the Big Bang sound like? That question has driven Dr. John Kramer, physicist at the University of Washington, to try and recreate the sound of the universe just after the Big Bang. He is a physicist and science fiction writer as well. Dr. Kramer, good to see you again.
Nice to be here.
Is this the sound that we're going to listen to? Is this the bang that created the world?
No. What happened was early in the universe was very small, very dense, and it was a closed system. And so this is a setup for having sound waves resonating back and forth in it. And these sound waves are present, and depending on what was in the universe, the sound would have come out in somewhat different ways. And it left a fingerprint. Basically, the places where the sound waves were very intense made the universe a little hotter, and where it was very quiet left the universe a little cooler. And that heat or coolness stayed there, and it's still. And about 376,000 years after the Big Bang, light was released when electrons and protons became hydrogen atoms and transparent, and that temperature variation was imprinted on that. And scientists are now studying that light, and they can see the temperature variations and recreate what was going on in the early universe.
So the sound preceded the light?
Yes.
That's sort of remarkable.
The light was there, but it was trapped because the universe was full of charged particles, and light doesn't get very far in a medium that's full of charged particles. And what happened 376,000 years afterwards was that the charged particles became hydrogen atoms, became neutral, and the light was suddenly set free. And so that's called the cosmic microwave background today.
What changed in the makeup of the universe? And how do you know it's 375,000 years?
That's part of what comes out of these studies we're talking about. And what changed was it got cooler, and it got cool enough so hydrogen atoms could form. And when hydrogen atoms formed, the universe became transparent and light was released.
So tell me again what the sound was doing in those first moments.
Well, it's like a closed system. If you take a bell or something, basically you have vibrations that are trapped in the medium and they go back and forth and reflect. And that was going on in the universe. And the matter vibrated one way, the dark matter vibrated another way, the dark energy vibrated another way, and we can decode that and find out how much of each of those there was in the early universe and how fast it was expanding.
I just like the idea that sound was so influential in the creation of the early universe.
Yeah, when they were publicizing the Alien movies, they said nobody can hear you scream in space. But in the early universe, if you'd been there, you could have screamed because it was plenty dense and plenty of medium for having sound waves. And so it was only after a long time after that that it became a good vacuum in the universe. And so the early universe was a very dense medium, a lot more dense than the atmosphere of the Earth.
How did you conceive of this?
Well, it's an interesting story. I write a column in Analog Magazine every other month, and I had written about a balloon flight where they were studying this cosmic microwave background, and the scientists who were working on it represented what they were looking at as the sound of the Big Bang, and so that was in my article. And a couple of years later, a mother sent me an email saying that her son, Daniel, was in the fifth grade, and he was giving a report to his class about the Big Bang, and they had come across my article on the internet about the sound of the Big Bang, and they wanted to know whether it was recorded anyway so that Daniel could play it to his class. And I sort of laughed about this at the time, and then I thought about it, and I'm very good at using a program called Mathematica, made by Wolfram Enterprises, that allows you to take a mathematical function and make it into a sound file. And so it occurred to me that all I had to do was to put the data from some of these cosmic microwave background measurements into Mathematica, and I can make a sound file. So that's what I did. I put in the sound waves that a satellite experiment called COBE. I'm spacing on the name of it now. Anyway, the 2003 data from WMAP, that was what I'm trying to think of, had become available, and so I put that into the program. I also put in the fact that the universe is expanding and becoming more of a base instrument, so there was a Doppler shift going on. And I also put in the fact that the cosmic microwave background was rising to a crescendo and then falling off again, and so that modulated the volume. And those three things were put together to make the sound file. And I sent it to by email to Daniel's mother, and she reported that it was a great success with their class. And I also told a science reporter for New Scientist magazine about it, and he publicized it. And the next thing I know, the University of Washington computer that I had the sound files on was brought to its knees by so many accesses of people trying to get to the sound of the Big Bang. And so that was in 2003, and recently the Planck satellite from the European Space Agency has done improved measurements where they've extended the sound range by a factor of 3, going to higher frequencies. And so I decided I should probably make a new high fidelity version with the new frequencies, and so that's what's going on now.
All right, so here, put those headphones on so you can listen to it,
right,
and you can describe it for me as we listen to the sound of the universe.
Okay, you're hearing a drop in frequency as the universe expands and becomes more of a bass instrument, and you're hearing it get louder and louder as the cosmic microwave background is building up to a crescendo. You hear a little bit of beat frequencies there where it's going wah-wah-wah a little bit. Now this is about as loud as it gets, and now it's falling off in volume as the cosmic microwave background falls off.
When is this in terms of the?
The middle of it is 376,000 years, and this goes about twice that. So it sort of sounds like an airplane flying over your house in the middle of the night because of the Doppler shift is sort of like what you hear when something like that happens.
Now we're close to about 375,000.
No, it's getting almost twice that now. It's about to stop. It's getting quieter and quieter. The light didn't come out all at once. It built up and then it fell off again. And so that's what's being reproduced by the rise and fall of the volume.
So about now the universe is pretty quiet.
Yeah, now the light has all been released and it's going its way. And that light has been traveling ever since. And when these people put up these satellites to do the measurements, they're looking at the light that goes all the way back to that period.
No more sound from the universe.
No, it's no more. Well, the sound was very early. This is a fingerprint of the sound we're listening to.
Yeah. But today, up there, it is the silent space we think of.
Yes.
That's remarkable. Was that fun?
Yeah, that was great. A great deal of fun.
I mean, just coming up with that. Why does Mathematica exist to convert data into sound?
Well, Mathematica is basically a program that does algebra for you. I probably could have been. I'm an experimental physicist. I probably could have been a theoretical physicist if I didn't make so many algebra mistakes when I was doing calculations. And Mathematica is a way of fixing that problem by doing the algebra for me, and so I can do really fancy calculations with it. Somebody had the bright idea that one wants to represent mathematical functions as graphs, as pictures, and also as sound waves, and so they built all of that into the program, and I'm pretty good at using it, so I figured out how to do it with the Big Bang sound, and it didn't take that long. I did it all in one Saturday morning, I tweaked it quite a bit after that. But the basic work was involved in writing about a 16-line Mathematica program one Saturday morning when I should have been doing my income tax or something.
And then you walked out to your family and said, I just figured out what the universe sounded like at the beginning of the Big Bang.
My PC has a nice woofer speaker on it. And I have three Shetland sheep, or I at the time had three Shetland sheepdogs. And so when I first played the sound of the Big Bang, my two male dogs came running into the room as they didn't know what was going on. And they looked around and they looked around and then they looked at the speaker and saw it was there. And then they lay down on the floor and stared at it. And I'm not sure why I got that reaction from the dogs, but it was really interesting. They don't usually behave quite that way.
Well, that's interesting. That is interesting. Maybe they were remembering something they learned in the past. does this tell us anything new or unique about how we our understanding of the origins of the universe?
Well, you can say the sound waves are just another way of presenting the data, but the new data tells us some interesting things. The universe is about 600 million years older than we thought it was. Now, 60 million years older than we thought it was, and it's expanding a little slower. There's a bit more matter and a bit more dark matter in the universe than we thought, and a bit less dark energy. The new Planck data sort of revised a number of numbers so that we now know a little better how much of what the universe is made of and how fast it's expanding.
And does it give you the next experimental direction?
Well, the data goes into cosmological models, okay? And a model is sort of a mathematical representation of how you think things work, and you're often wrong. People are tweaking their models to accommodate this new data and trying to find new directions that it suggests. There are some funny things going on in the low frequency region of this new Planck data that people don't understand. The quadrupole and the octopole components are not as big, are a lot larger than they would have expected.
Should I know what an octopole and a quadrupole is?
A dipole does like this. A quadrupole goes in four directions, an octopole goes in eight directions, and it's a way of breaking up space into angular regions in two to the n. So it goes from 2 to 4 to 8 to 16 to 32, and that's the way these people have decomposed the data that they've gotten. And so the two lowest frequencies are funny, and people don't understand why. And This might tell you something about something in the universe, or it might be something wrong with their instruments.
You know, I talked to you a long time ago. You wrote two books. You've written two books, right? Twister, Einstein's Bridge, two science fiction books.
That's right.
How does the science influence your science fiction over time?
Well, I guess it started off with many years ago when I was on a committee of the Division of Nuclear Physics, which was going around and visiting congressmen and telling them how worthy it was to support science. And I discovered that the people who are making most of the scientific decisions are guys who just got out of law school and last had science when they were in junior high or something, and could really use a little extra information. So I started trying to figure out how to write a one-page summary of some important piece of physics that I thought was worth bringing to their attention. And this led to me writing a column every other month in Analog Magazine, 2,000 words. They're on the web. If you chase down Kramer and Alternate View with Google, and you'll find them.
I just did that.
And after doing this for a while, I decided I should drop the other shoe, because the problem is I was talking about a lot of scientific results, but I wasn't talking about the way science is really done, which is quite different from a lot of the way it's often portrayed in the movies and television and so forth.
It sounds like you do it on a Saturday morning in your slippers.
Yeah, sometimes. But, yeah, I mean, sometimes you have a bright idea in the middle of the night and you get up and do things, but usually it's a lot of work in the laboratory. But anyway, I thought it was worth portraying how this was done, so I wrote Twister, which is set at the University of Washington. People doing a more or less mundane experiment get an unexpected result, which involves transport to a shadow universe, another Earth that's like ours, except the animals are six-legged instead of four-legged and so forth. And that was a lot of fun. And then some years later, I had the bright idea that they were about to build the superconducting supercollider in Waxahachie, and it would be a good idea to write a science fiction novel that was based there so that when the machine came on the air, one could take advantage of the publicity that was generated by the operation of the machine. Well, what happened in the middle of this, after the novel was like 90% finished, was that the United States Congress canceled the project, and I was devastated. And a couple of years later, when I was on sabbatical in Munich, I had the bright idea of how to fix it, which was to make it into a time travel novel in which protagonists go back in time and make sure that the accelerator doesn't – something terrible happens, and they go back in time and make sure the accelerator doesn't get built. So the first part of the novel portrays work at the superconducting supercollider, and the last half portrays manipulating the Reagan and Bush and Clinton administrations in order to get the superconducting supercollider canceled. And
a little revenge,
right?
You know, do you still work at Brookhaven National Laboratory?
Yeah, I'm going there next week for 8 days to run shifts on the STAR experiment at Brookhaven.
And what is that? The STAR solenoidal tracker at Brookhaven, relatively heavy ion collider.
It's basically a big cylindrical magnet with a big cylindrical volume inside that has an electric field. And when you make charged particle tracks in the electric field, they drift to the ends, and so you get an electronic image of a collision between two very heavy nuclei that produce maybe 4,000 or 5,000 charged particles in each collision. And so we get these starbursts of data from these collisions, and then we have to sort it out and put Humpty Dumpty back together again and try to figure out what happened in the initial stages of the collision. This represents sort of like the first microsecond of the Big Bang. The temperatures are about the same, and so we can sort of probe matter in this state that we have no other way of getting access to. And what we've learned, among other things, is that the early universe, when it was really hot and in this early stages, the first microsecond was much more like a liquid than it was like a hot gas. And nobody had expected that before we got these results.
Doing basic science. Is it fun? Do you have fun doing it?
A lot of fun, yeah. I like doing experimental physics. I figured out I wanted to be a physicist when I was in junior high school, and I sort of started taking metal shop courses and engineering drawing courses and things so I could learn to build experimental equipment, and I've been having a great time ever since.
Dr. John Kramer is a University of Washington physicist, a professor, science fiction writer. Even though you're retired, you're still working. You're still teaching, so that just tells us how much you like it. And it gave us a sense of how the Big Bang sounded. In those first few thousand, 100,000 years. Thank you, sir.
Thank you. If you want to find out more about this, look, Google Kramer and Sound of Big Bang, and you ought to be able to find it.
Yeah, we have a few links as well, and also at our Facebook page, Weekday on KUOW. This is Weekday.
Now we're going to turn from the sounds of the early universe to the sounds of songbirds. That's mere seconds away.
Support for KUOW comes from the EnviroStars Business Certification Program, recognizing EnviroStars King County Housing Authority's Briarwood Apartments in Shoreline for its commitment to environmentally sustainable business practices. A directory of businesses meeting certification standards is available at envirostars.org.
51 degrees in Seattle under a mostly cloudy sky. Looks like clouds through the day with a continuing chance of showers and a high of 54. I'm Bernard Ouellette. It's 10:23. Working less, but getting more out of it in 20 minutes.
Thirteen Connected Tales. Brian Kimberling tells the story of Nathan Lockmuller, an aimless college grad. That's how it was portrayed. He seemed like a typical college grad to me, who wanders through his early 20s into the world of songbird research. Brian Kimberling himself spent 2 years as a professional bird watcher, researcher in southern Indiana. He joins us to talk about his new novel, debut novel, Snapper. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And like we were just chatting, hence we took a little longer to turn on the mics. You know the book, Birds of Paradise, that we talked to these guys an hour ago?
I have a copy of it. I've just glanced at it. I haven't actually gone through it carefully.
So, yes, that reveals something. You write about birds. You have birds on the cover of Snapper. Are you still a bird person?
I watch what's going on in my back garden, but...
That's it?
In England. I live in England. And that's about it, yeah.
You had enough?
I was a research assistant for a major study of Indiana songbirds for 2 summers in the mid-90s. And there were about 30 or 40 people doing that job around Bloomington, Indiana every year. You don't have to look around to find someone now who did that job, but I was the first to make a book out of it.
Why was that happening? Or is it still happening?
It probably still is happening, and it's probably not unique to Indiana. A lot of songbirds' populations are fluctuating, and they need to be monitored.
I mean, fluctuating is a nice way to put it.
Yeah. So,
but Indiana, because it's on the flyway, is that why it's?
Good question. I think Indiana, because there was a major university there, and so they had the,
oh, so they got
resources
the,
to do
they
it.
They got the resources.
The thing is, I wasn't very good at this job owing to a hearing impairment. I couldn't tell where the birds were singing from. But I was very jealous of the people who were good at it. It was very romantic work, wandering around the forest and fighting the good fight. I was so jealous of them that I made my own fantasy career 17 years later in fictional form.
Why? What did you actually do?
Well, I read a lot of books while I was waiting for the birds to forget I was there. But it's just a question of echolocating. I couldn't tell. I could tell what bird was singing, but I couldn't tell where it was. So I turned slowly in circles, and other people just knew.
And Nathan Lockmuller, on the other hand, had a gift.
Yes, he.
Your character in Snapper.
The protagonist of Snapper, Nathan Lockmuller, learns to echolocate in the forest and effectively track quarry by listening to the birds.
Yeah. Though it doesn't all come to a good end for him anyways.
No, it doesn't. There was a review in the Seattle Times yesterday, and I loved one line, which if it weren't so funny, this book would be a total downer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's a good thing you made it funny.
Yeah, well, I mean, I was very happy with that line. That's what I intended.
Because otherwise, you make it sound like life in Indiana is a total downer.
Well, in some sense, I mean, it's very savage toward Indiana at some points, but in another sense, it's a love song. It's kind of like that country song, "You're the Reason Our Kids Are Ugly," which is a love song.
Yeah, well, a lot of country music's like that, isn't it?
Yeah.
So I could think of it that way. I could think of it as your, why don't we get drunk and do things?
And the pickup truck's always breaking down, and the dog won't shut up, and the leading lady's always running around. So I really was thinking of a country song when I wrote it.
Why is the Southern Indiana so much like the South in your book? Is it Southern Indiana a lot like the South?
Yes, it is.
I don't mean to be, you know, downing. Being down in the South, I mean the image of the South we have in some literature. How's that?
Well, there are two things there. One is that, and as suggested in the book, Evansville is ecologically a little bit Southern.
Is that right?
And then, you know, the people on the borders of the South are the most Southern people there are. Indiana isn't quite in Kentucky, but there's a sort of, there's something there. And I was personally influenced by a lot of Southern short story writers, Peter Taylor, Catherine Ann Porter, Eudora Welty, Ellen Gilchrist. And I tried and tried and tried for many years to be a Southern writer, but I'm not. I'm Midwestern, and sometimes the material just takes over.
What's the difference? What do you mean the material takes over? You mean the fact that you were a Midwesterner in the end shows itself?
There's a scene in the book where a lady suggests putting some eggs in the radiator to fix the car, which actually works, by the way. That's a bit of good folk mechanics, or it used to work before radiators were all sealed. And that scene reminds me of a Coen Brothers film. They're from Indiana. And it's the material is Midwestern somehow. And in the South, I don't know what the equivalent would be, but it wouldn't be eggs in the radiator.
You describe the little towns in Indiana in a way that makes them seem formerly quaint and character full of characters. Is it like that?
Some of them are and some of them aren't.
Well, give me one that's a real town comparable to some little towns that your character wanders through.
Story, Indiana is a very charming little hamlet. But Gnawbone, I mean, I love the name Gnawbone, Indiana. There's nothing there but a self-storage place. There are a lot of places like that too. I just looked at a map and picked out the most distinctive names: Bird's Eye and Buddha and Gnawbone and Bean Blossom and Story.
Bean Blossom was a real place in Indiana.
Yes, they
not have, just a place you made up for your character to say.
No, they have a bluegrass festival there every year. I've never been.
Where did you live and go to school?
I grew up in Evansville, and then I went to Indiana University in Bloomington.
And you don't particularly like the cloistered liberal ecology of those college towns?
I love Bloomington, actually. I spent
three months. Nathan doesn't like it.
Nathan doesn't like it. He does disparage every place he talks about. I got to a very late draft, and I realized I hadn't impugned Indianapolis, and I thought this was a terrible...
Well, you made up for it, if I'm not mistaken.
I did make up for it, but his opinions are not always mine.
Why is he so against the what does he call it, liberal orthodoxy of and I think especially the environmentalists. He doesn't like environmentalists sometimes.
Oh, he doesn't like the jingoistic.
Yeah. What does he mean by that, jingoistic?
Well, because he's really doing some hard work. He doesn't like the people who pay lip service to
Describe what it's like for his. What is his work like? Describe the environment that he goes into in those forests.
The songbird populations may be fluctuating, but the mosquito population is very robust, and the deer ticks and the heat and the swampy armpits, and it's kind of awful. He climbs a lot of trees. At one point, a bald eagle attacks somebody, stole his fish. It's a pretty hazardous place. There are malevolent turtles and sadistic warblers. It's quite an absurd locale.
Did you encounter malevolent turtles and sadistic warblers in your months of research?
I was dive bombed by a hooded warbler once. She's about the size of a golf ball, but she didn't want me probing her nest.
Yeah, well, I don't see why not.
I never actually encountered a malevolent turtle. Of course, I've seen snapping turtles, but I never came to grief, and no one I know ever came to grief as a result.
Could you describe, is southern Indiana mostly rural still?
Evansville's pretty big, 130,000 by Indiana standards.
Yeah,
that's
sure.
Pretty big. Elsewhere, there's really not much. I just drove through it on this book tour recently. And a lot of the towns, you see houses and churches and shops shuttered, and there's just a gas station.
So people like you were leaving.
Yeah, well, I think that's always been true, that Indiana exports its coal, timber, steel, and 18-year-olds to some other place, and it leaves behind these communities it's hard to feel any sense of belonging to.
Does it still have timber? Is it reforested?
Oh, it has a lot of tree farms that are called state parks, but they actually just harvest timber every 7 years or something.
Is that right? So it's like, and they're state parks, they're not even state forests, they call them both.
Where I actually worked was Yellowwood State Forest, and it's carefully managed, we'll put it that way, but they do a lot of logging when they can.
Tell me about the other character that runs through this book, Lola.
She's a very free spirit. She persuades him to paint his pickup truck in a rather embarrassing way. It's called the Gypsy Moth, and it's got fairies and mushrooms and butterflies everywhere.
He's quite a hippie for the era he's living in.
Yeah, he's a free spirit too, though. And they, in some sense, the book for both of them is about the problem of being from Indiana and the problem of being in Indiana and then the problem of being somewhere else. And there's no... It's about the problem of being human, really.
Well, she goes to Michigan, he goes to Vermont. But are they still tied to Indiana?
In the sense that you are where you come from.
Do you feel that way in London, in England, rather?
Oh, yeah.
This was your book that you wrote to remember your roots?
Well, no, I've lived in the Czech Republic, Mexico, Turkey, and now England. And when I tell people where I'm from, they say, well, do you know Bobby Knight personally? That one's fading with time. Or they ask if there are a lot of Indians in Indiana. This book is the result of a 17-year itch to tell people where I'm really from.
Do they ever ask you if there's a, if there's KKK in Indiana, if there's Southerners driving pickup trucks and shooting guns and all the things that we don't have that, you know, that, that, that story of Indiana maybe in our heads, but that you write about in this book?
Sometimes people ask about that, yeah. And I, of course, there is a section of the book that goes heavily into KKK history in Indiana. Seems to me like something to grab by the horns and see where it threw me.
Yeah, where did it throw you?
Good question. You might have to read the book.
No, where did it throw you? Where did it throw you personally? I mean, did it surprise you that you had that sort of history?
No, so there's an incident related in the book about a cross burning by the side of the highway as this all-black basketball team goes up for the state championship. That happened to my high school team.
To your high school team?
Mm-hmm. And I showed the book to a friend who also went to the same high school, and this was like 6 months ago, and he said, I remember that happening, but it's weird to see it written down in a book. And I said, good.
Yeah, but how does it affect Indiana, do you think? How does it shape? I mean, you know, throughout the characters in this book, they're kind of, some of them don't like the liberal orthodoxy of the Bloomingtons. You write about, your character, rather, writes about seeing the little towns turning into tourist traps or disappearing. But I wonder how that underlying racism that ran through the South part of, you know, you could put it to Illinois, you can put it to Ohio, how that, you can put it in Washington State and Oregon, too. How that affected you once you started thinking about it, writing about it, and change your perception of the state?
I'm not sure how to answer that.
Yes or no is fine.
I think that people in Indiana either get outraged about it or shush about it, and nobody really just discusses it frankly, and I wanted to discuss it frankly. I probably had to live in Britain to do it because I didn't feel, you know, like I would be judged or something. If I lived in Indiana, it would be very difficult to write about that section of Indiana history, I think.
Where are your folks living now?
They live in Evansville.
Yeah. What did they think?
My mom said she might skip town around publication time, but I did a reading in Evansville and it was very well received. They don't get written about much down there.
Yeah, well, it's one of those states that, that doesn't get a lot of attention until your senator does something that surprises people.
Yeah, well, my congressional representative a few years ago, right after 9/11, he got on a commercial flight with a loaded handgun, said he forgot it was in his bag. He had to be from Indiana.
Brian Kimmerling is the author of Snapper, his debut novel, Tales of Nathan Lockmuller, and all the other people in Indiana who spend a lot of time having a good time and wondering if they should. Thank you.
Thank you.
He'll be reading tonight at Elliott Bay at 7 o'clock. This is Weekday.
Navigating uncertainty in life and in work, in a minute.
Support for KUOW comes from LeMay, America's Car Museum, which celebrates its first anniversary with a June 1st gala. The evening features musical entertainment, cars, catering by El Gaucho, and a preview of the new Legends of NASCAR exhibit. Details at lemaymuseum.org.
I'm Armin Altney. On the next To the Point, when the Twitter account of the Associated Press was hijacked, Wall Street was spooked by a fake report about White House explosions. Is media hacking just a nuisance or a threat to national stability? Will Washington's focus on cybersecurity intrude on the privacy of corporations or individual internet users? Next time on To the Point from Public Radio International.
That's 35 minutes away on KUOW 94.9 Seattle.
Support for KUOW comes from Franz Chocolate, celebrating 30 years of handcrafting artisan confections in Seattle, now featuring Mother's Day gift assortments. Stores downtown First and Union, University Village, Bellevue on Old Main Street, and at franzchocolates.com.
51 degrees in Seattle, expecting to reach 54 today with clouds and showers. Overnight, we'll drop down to 39, and then tomorrow, Tuesday, they say it's going to be partly sunny with a high of 57. 1039, I'm Bernard Bolette. President Obama is nominating Anthony Fox, the mayor of Charlotte, North Carolina, to run the Transportation Department. More about that in 20 minutes.
The downturn in the economy forced many older citizens to reexamine their retirement plans. Traditional retirement may not be in the future for many workers, but neither is the notion of 40-hour work weeks at unloved jobs. New opportunities are opening up for older people, for younger people. The systems to help find new rewarding careers are just developing. But first, you have to think about your transition, and planning for a transition can be part of the transition. Carol Vecchio is founder and executive director of Centerpoint, author of a new book, Time Between Dreams, which helps people think about their transitions. Good to see you.
Good to be here. Thanks, Steve.
First of all, Centerpoint in Seattle, what's your mission statement?
Our mission is to offer lifelong tools to navigate uncertainty, build meaningful careers, and design courageous lives.
It's very nice.
Mm-hmm.
When did you start it?
We started in 1992, so we just celebrated our 21st anniversary, just entering that year.
And have you had people come back and say, you helped me with a courageous life?
Oh, absolutely. It's really amazing to have people come back so frequently. You know, it's not that they need a lot the next time, but they need just some support and they know where to come.
What prompted you to do that?
To do Centerpoint?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, I went through my own transition, as we all do, 20-some-odd years ago, and couldn't live where I was living anymore, and had to figure out what was the best place to be for me. And I transitioned to Seattle, which is the most ideal place in the entire universe, and it just works perfectly for me. And but what I was looking for in terms of work didn't exist. I was looking for a group of people who had similar values, similar approaches, who we could work together and create an organization and a service that would really serve people no matter what socioeconomic level they were at, no matter whether they had money or not, because really career development only is accessible to people who can pay for it. So we thought as a nonprofit, we would be able to have sliding scale and other ways of being able to support people.
And that's worked out.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it has.
You talk about it this way. You quote another development therapist. It's not about fitting yourself into work. It's about finding out how work fits into your life. And you talk about the inside-out approach.
Yes.
What is that?
Well, it's so important, especially in the 21st century, because, you know, a third of the U.S. workforce is now freelancing. That's a lot of people who are not working in what they call core jobs with benefits. And that number is just going to grow more and more. So the kind of the approach that we take to job search has to change, the way that we figure out what work we're going to do. In the past, it's always been, so what job is out there? How can I fit myself into that? What field is increasing in terms of opportunities? And how do I prepare for that? But we don't know if those opportunities are still going to be there in the future. So we have to go from, who am I? What do I love? What comes naturally to me? What do I want to make a difference with? What's meaningful to me? And then look at what's out there that fits that.
So two things on that.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is an unnerving thing that you write about in here, you talk about in here. Mm-hmm. You're talking about workers that are not necessarily going to have health care, not necessarily going to have retirement plans,
right,
and not necessarily going to be actually part of a company that is going to help them be stable and secure. So that's just what we have to suck up in the 21st century of American capitalism?
I think that's where we're going. I mean, with a third of the workforce there now, putting together part-time positions, doing contract work, that's where we're going. And people need to be prepared for it. But we're still living off of the old rules and the old ways of doing things. And that's where it can get really confusing.
You mean in our heads?
Yeah.
In our heads, we're doing
mm-hmm.
that.
Mm-hmm. We think it still works that way.
And mm-hmm. Is this for everybody? I mean, is this for the person who lost their job in a mill? Is this for the person who has been working in restaurants as a, you know, delivery guy? Is it for the entire
spectrum of income.
Yes, it is. Because we all have innate talents. We all want a life that matters in some way or another. And it doesn't mean that our work is going to be the focus of that mattering. It could be that family is the real key to giving my life meaning and purpose. And work is a way to support that. But we need to make those choices instead of just falling into things or being in something that doesn't work and we're miserable at, because we make everybody else miserable around us.
Carol Vecchio is founder and executive director of Centerpoint and author of a new book, Time Between Dreams. So you write about the cyclical approach, and you write about it, you kind of give it a, well, you don't kind of, it's a seasonal approach.
Mm-hmm.
Fall, winter, spring, and summer.
It's a metaphor that we use to help people understand the cycle in a way that makes sense.
And why does that make sense? Mm-hmm. Why does that cyclical seasonal approach mm-hmm. make sense?
For two reasons. One, the seasons are a natural process that unfolds. Nothing that we can do will make it, like, it's spring in Seattle right now. Well, yeah, it's spring, but it's 50 degrees out there, and it sometimes hails like it did a couple of weeks ago, right? So we never know, and we can't control what's going to happen with the seasons. And to use that as a metaphor for our lives can be really useful, because we don't know what's going to happen in our lives. We don't know what's going to happen in the world. We don't know what's going to happen that we have to deal with. And we can't control it all the time. We can control our choices, but we can't control what happens in the external. And the other reason is that in just thinking about, well, summer, fall, winter, spring, not that those phases are going to happen in the actual seasons, but the characteristics of those seasons can be a useful tool in understanding this process.
For example,
well, summer is in full bloom. We're building, launching, making things happen. Fall, well, things are in decline. And leaves are falling off the trees. Things are dying. We need to deal with that. In winter, looks like everything's dead out there, maybe, if you look at the indigenous trees and you just have no leaves on them. They look dead. But under the surface, lots is happening. In spring, things are budding. More energy's occurring, and we can actually create something in the world that makes sense for us. So just using those as a way of talking about it, a way to communicate it, can be helpful for folks.
You do point out, though, that, as you said just now, all those seasons have stormy parts. How's that? That's
mm-hmm.
a reasonable way to put it.
Yes.
So we may be in spring, but spring does not necessarily mean we're moving towards blossoming.
Right.
We're still figuring out what needs to be pruned or...
Yes.
Replant it.
Yes, we call it.
I'm just going to continue to use your metaphor.
The slosh, the muddy parts of spring.
All right, so.
And can I also say that we're not just in any one place on that cycle? There's so many different parts of our lives that are going through change simultaneously. Well, that's where it gets confusing.
You talked about it as one other way to look at it is mini transitions.
Mm-hmm.
We have to recognize we're engaged in these mini transitions. What do you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Well, in a particular season, quote unquote, that we're in, sometimes we're not ready.
Now that it's your metaphor, you have to own it.
Okay. we're not necessarily ready to move to that next step or that next season. So sometimes we have to create temporary choices within a season to allow us to prepare for the next. So in fall, well, like squirreling away the acorns for an unknown winter, right? Sometimes we have to do some financial planning. We have to do some, maybe even take a job or reduce the number of hours in our job so that we can prepare for the unknown of winter.
What you're trying to do is give people a way to maintain their eye on the prize.
Mm-hmm.
To now mix my metaphors, while they are recognizing that not just mini transitions to be stable, but anger wells up, mm-hmm. you fall back into patterns that you've had in the past, and
that's right.
That can direct your thinking.
Mm-hmm.
So you're trying to give people tools to notice that the larger goals are still available.
Yes.
What's
yes.
a positive plateau?
A positive plateau is where we're in summer, and in the beginning of summer, it takes a lot of energy and We're trying to go from challenge to mastery in some part of our life. Well, the positive plateau is where we've arrived at some level of that, and it feels solid. It's like in a relationship we can think about where, you know, yeah, there's some change going on, but you feel like you could really count on it. Same thing in a job. You know, that's a positive plateau. You're reaping the benefits. The garden is in full bloom, and now we're able to pick the fruit.
Well, I like these questions you ask. The most important things to ask of ourselves at the positive plateau. Is my vision still alive? Mm-hmm. So that's just a reminder of, you know, keep your eye on the prize. Mm-hmm. Do I still love, I guess, what you're doing or what your vision is? And then I like this. What's my energy level like? Do I still have a lot of enthusiasm to continue to build my vision? Because that's where we kind of drop out of it, right?
Yes.
Our energy level easily sags.
Mm-hmm. Yep, and that's how we know we've sort of crossed the line into fall, where, you know, it's a little hard to get out of bed, and I just don't have the energy that I used to have, and I don't know how to get back and have that feel that excitement again. It's just not there. So energy and clarity are really the two things that we want to pay attention to see where we are in the cycle.
So what's the tool by which we take the inwardly directed anger that shows up as self-criticism, mm-hmm. quoting you again, mm-hmm. and turn it back into, back on the positive path? Or do we just, I know you wouldn't say wallow, but do we just wallow in it for a while?
We notice it. We notice, I'm angry about this. Or I'm, the externally directed anger is that victimization that we feel, right? But the inwardly directed is always when we beat ourselves up. But just to notice, wow, yeah, I'm in this stage now. It's actually a very good thing because the phase before anger is denial. So at least we're not in denial anymore. So we know that the process is moving. So to acknowledge that, acknowledge where we are and acknowledge, okay, I'm in this anger stage. How am I feeling? How do I deal with these feelings? How do I not be in denial about it anymore? Because, you know, we can circle through all of those phases in the grieving process and we're letting go of a vision. So it's normal and natural to go through those stages. And just to recognize. So when we teach this model to people at CenterPoint, it really helps them gain a new perspective. You know, what kind of questions do I need to ask myself? Because I now have sort of a map on how to go through this process instead of it just being totally confusing.
All right, what's spring?
Spring is where we have a vision, and a vision is not a job title, and it's not an organization out there. A vision is a description of what I want to make a difference with, who I am. And then we take that description, and we're ready, because the energy has started to come back, we're ready to go explore.
And the energy is coming back because we acknowledged it.
Yes, because we stepped back to uncover the clues of who I am and what's exciting to me and what I want to make a difference with and what I find passion in my life, what I find passionate about in my life.
And so then spring, these are transitions.
Mm-hmm.
Transitions are hard.
Yes, they are.
How do we manage those? How do we cope with the difficulty of those transitions?
Mm-hmm. One,
given these tools you have handed me.
Yeah.
My seasonal tools.
Uh-huh. To acknowledge that it is a process that we go through. And it isn't about just picking something and going for it. It isn't about ignoring or denying the energy level that we're feeling or the feelings that we're feeling. That we really have to, again, that's why it's an inside-out process, to acknowledge our own inside whatever's happening to me so that I can understand how that fits into the greater picture.
But why don't I just end up in an endless loop of negativity?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, what's the energy, what's the action that gets me through the door to the next phase?
Usually you have to be in enough discomfort to say, you know, I can't do this anymore this way.
People pick up bottles of liquor or they do all mm-hmm. sorts of things.
Sure.
To avoid, once they feel that discomfort mm-hmm. and say that to themselves.
That's right.
So what gets them?
Sometimes it can be an external thing. It's a wake-up call of some sort. We all have them in our lives.
I know. You liked some of these people were happy to be fired.
Yes. Yes. They were looking for it. They were hoping for it because they knew in their heart of hearts that they were miserable. And they weren't being able to be there for their families, for their friends, for their for themselves. So yes, but there's a wake up call. Sometimes we do get fired, or our spouse leaves us, or something happens in our lives to just actually bring it to the forefront. Sometimes it's health issues, because if we've been hanging on a really long time to what we've been doing and it hasn't been working, we'll feel the stress in our bodies and our support areas will break down. You know, neck, knee, back problems. Often we see I can't tell you how many broken legs we've seen in the office.
Really?
Yeah, it's really an interesting phenomenon. Well, talk about stopping you dead in your tracks. If you have a broken leg, it slows you down. And it gives you the space to think about what's really going on here. What's happening? So lots of different wake-up calls can...
Sometimes a broken leg isn't just a broken leg.
Right, right.
You asked this question in your title, your chapter is Working With, Not Against the Cycles. And the first, how long is this going to take? Mm-hmm. How long is this going to take?
How long? How big a transition is it? If it's a big transition, if it's a letting go of a huge identity in our life, the transition is going to take longer. And it can take a year or two, sometimes even longer. If it's a smaller transition, if we're just changing some piece of what we're doing, then it's not going to take that long.
Well, you say two things. Mm-hmm. One, you can't skip it.
Right.
The stages are there for a reason, mm-hmm. just like stages of grief are there for a reason, I imagine, huh?
Yes, and the seasons.
You have to just deal with them. Can't mm-hmm. skip the season. Mm-hmm. That's right. Mm-hmm. And secondly, even if you forget everything else, you say, commit these two next guidelines to memory. The second one is you can't skip anything. The first one is energy is always available for the next small step. How do you know that?
You check in with yourself, because down deep we know. What do I have energy for? What do I need right now? What do I want right now? What's really important for me to get right now? And sometimes our heads say, you shouldn't get that. That shouldn't be part of it. Like your head might say, I need a nap. And you're the rest of you are going, no, I have to stay in action. I have to figure this thing out. But you know, until you get that nap, there won't be energy available to take that next step. So you've got to follow that energy.
Oh, I like that idea.
Yeah.
I can take a nap.
Well, you're going on sabbatical, aren't you?
That's right. I'm going on a sabbatical. I guess I'll be napping for some of that time.
If that's what you need.
I found this useful for thinking about the sabbatical. 5 month sabbatical. I have a goal. But mm-hmm. the goal is for me, monumental. Mm-hmm. So I'm using you as my little sounding board here. And I found this book useful because it is hard to stay positive.
Yeah.
Because you're facing all these unknowns. Mm-hmm. I can tell myself, have the energy. I can tell myself, but what you're saying is I should tell myself, listen to my nap cycle.
Yes, yes. Listen to what you really do need, because the wisdom is in each of us. We have that information there. It's readily accessible. But sometimes, our heads get in the way. We try to get into action or do something to avoid that or to think, oh, that's not important, or that's going to just confuse things more. But we really need to take those natural steps. That's why we call it a natural cycle of change.
Very good. And can you see how I naturally had you come in the day before I was working my last day? I appreciate that. I'm using all my this radio time just to get some clarity. I appreciate that.
My pleasure.
Carol Vecchio's book is The Time Between Dreams, How to Navigate Uncertainty in Your Life and Work. She is founder and executive director of Centerpoint. We have links at KUOW.org, and also we'll get some up on our Facebook page if they're not there, weekday on KUOW. I appreciate you talking to us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me here.
I appreciate it. All right, we'll do it again tomorrow, shall we? Not you and I, but you may come back if you like. But
oh, I'd love to come back. That would be great.
But we'll do it again tomorrow otherwise. Bernardo Letts, our engineer. Weekdays produced by Katie Sewell, Jason Pagano, Amina Asade, Jason Pagano. We're also going to talk with the governor tomorrow, what he thinks about that special session, and gluten-free girl, vegan before 6, Mark Bitford, and then we'll garden. So we'll get our bodies ready for transitions. Do join us. This is Weekday.
President Obama today spoke before and praised the National Academy of Sciences. That's in the news in a minute. KUOW-FM Seattle, KUOW Tumwater, KQOW Bellingham, and Digital HD Services.
Support for KUOW comes from Washington's Lottery, supporting the Washington Opportunity Pathways account to help fund higher education scholarships in Washington. More at walottery.com.
49 states now have laws on bullying. Schools have policies and punishments. But some say there's a risk that searching for solutions to bullying can do more harm than good. We'll hear that perspective today during the noon hour.
Support for KUOW comes from the Community of Mindful Parents, a website for information about classes like Listening Mothers and Reflective Parenting, as well as interactive conversations exploring the mindful path to stress-free, happy, well-adjusted families. Information online at communityofmindfulparents.com.
Some of the jobs that disappeared during the recession haven't come back. What have you seen in your line of work? Go to KUOW.org.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at KUOW.org.